You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 30th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
Evan, what happened today?
You mean today, April 2nd, on this day in history? 1845, the first surviving daguerreotype photograph showing details of the sun was taken by two French physicists.
Both of whom went blind shortly after.
They didn't realize that actually looking at it through a device will make you blind, which is a very nice image, which we were actually all just looking at not too long ago online.
Mm-hmm.
Shows the umbra, the structure of several sunspots, and as well as limb darkening.
What's that?
Oh, that's when your limbs go dark.
Thanks.
That's from going blind.
Yeah, it's a cool picture. I mean, I wouldn't know it was a daguerreotype if I didn't, if that wasn't labeled as such, just from looking at the picture itself. You know what I mean? Well, it just looks like a picture of the sun.
What's a daguerreotype?
It's a type of photograph that was used in the 1800s.
One of the original photograph inventions, styles of photography. Not Fox Talbot's invention, but Daguerre, I believe, was his name.
Yeah. And also April 2nd is World Autism Awareness Day. Yep. So be aware.
I'm aware that vaccines do not cause autism.
Excellent.
That can't be said for everyone. Speaking of just today, Jenny McCarthy on her Twitter account asked people to please tell her, I'll read you exactly. She said, "Tell me some of your can't live without products that you have used with your kids." And Jerry Duggan, a TV show writer, responded, "I'm happy with the polio vaccine."
Nice.
Wow. Oh,
nice.
Thought you guys would appreciate that.
No comment from Jenny on that one.
Yeah, I'm sure not.
Rebecca, tell us about this latest UFO snafu in Colorado.
I wouldn't call it a snafu. I would say that it was a very successful visit from the aliens. In Lafayette, Colorado, there were many reports of three distinct red lights flying through the sky. They were captured on video by a few people, and they've since ended up on YouTube, of course. The lights show them first in a triangular shape, and they're not making any audible noise, and none of the witnesses said they heard a noise.
You hear that a lot. There's a lot of triangular UFOs, right? But you know, any three points that aren't in a straight line are a triangle.
Hey!
Exactly. Yes.
Right. I think that's probably why there are so many triangular UFOs.
Pythagoras.
And the thing
proud.
Is, these three lights eventually moved into a straight line, and I guess that is also considered a hallmark of UFOs.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly why or how. But apparently this was a magical occurrence, and people were really freaked out because they had never seen anything like this. They didn't think that the lights were behaving the way that airplanes, for instance, do. So, of course, that means that they must be aliens. And there's a local news report that, finds some random idiots on the street to say that there's a weird feeling in the air, and it was spooky and things like that. Some of my favorite headlines, well, my absolute favorite headline I've seen in the Denver Post, "Some baffled after UFO sighting claims in Lafayette." Some baffled.
Nice. Oh my God.
Somewhat. I don't know. It's not even, it doesn't even have the distinction of saying like scientists are baffled. It's just someone.
That makes me think that some people aren't baffled and know exactly what it is, but the stupid people are baffled.
Right.
If it's even people, it just says some. We don't even know if it's people they're
Could
talking about.
Could be a
about.
Dog.
Some
Good
dogs.
Point.
Yeah.
Dog.
But in that news report, they did give the token skeptics a second, to say.
Yeah, there were some skeptics called on the street as well who basically said, "That's stupid."
Yeah. But those are our listeners.
right.
Who emailed us to alert
really?
Us to that fact. Yeah, Kevin.
Oh.
Kevin and his wife, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Oh,
awesome.
Yeah, I did read that. I did read that.
Yeah, he said, oh, I was like hungover, and all I could manage to say was that it was pretty wacky. that was the token skepticism.
I think that's the response that something like this requires. Because, you know, I'm not going to tell you what exactly these lights are because I don't know. I wasn't there. However, I think I can offer a few suggestions that are slightly more plausible than aliens visiting us from outer space to do an air show over Lafayette, Colorado. For instance, just going to throw some of these out there. The ever popular Chinese lantern theory.
Yep.
Chinese lanterns have been growing in popularity and they have been the cause of many a UFO sighting of late. They're little lanterns that you set alight and let go into the sky and they can sort of float above the sky and eventually disappear in the way that people claim that these disappeared.
Right.
Another possible explanation is that they actually were aircraft. It's possible to see lights from aircrafts in the sky without hearing noise. And oftentimes with air shows and things like that, you'll have some older aircraft in the sky that are flying in formation. It's not unheard of. It does happen. And it probably happens at a slightly higher rate than UFO visitation.
And there are lots of airports in the area. I mean, there are lots of military bases, Air Force bases in the area.
Lafayette is surrounded by four airports. So that's a very good possibility. And one more I'll throw out there is hoax, which has also been the cause of many a UFO sighting of late. It could be, you know, just some jokester, some prankster. It's just before April 1st. Sending some things into the air to fool with people. So all of these things slightly more plausible than aliens.
Do you guys remember on the Brady Bunch when the boys?
No.
Yeah, I'm going to continue. The boys pranked the sisters, and they put a mattress outside their window and shone a red light on it or something to make it look like a UFO.
Yeah. It was a flashlight and a slide whistle. That was their UFO.
Yeah. A slide whistle. Come on. I mean,
slide whistle mattress.
It's like, oh, they're UFO clowns or something. You know, a slide whistle. What is that?
It's funny. This UFO went flying by, and I heard dun 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 dun.
Why would you hear a slide whistle?
Love
ridiculous.
To radio.
Well, it was the 60s, Evan, you know.
I get
less
it.
Sophisticated.
I
back
get
then.
It. And I understand the point they were trying to make, or they were trying to make a pretty good skeptical point in that episode, but I think they kind of lost it a little bit.
I don't think there was anything skeptical about the Brady Bunch.
I love the commenters on websites discussing this and other UFO sightings where they say things like, oh, a military aircraft, that's implausible. That's why it has to be an alien spacecraft.
Right, obviously.
Yeah,
obviously.
That's a far-fetched idea, Steve, military aircraft. It's got to be alien.
Yeah, come on. Well, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is wrong.
I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, this was another week of annoying science headlines, but this one was special. This one really made my jaw drop a little when I read some of them. My favorite, of course, scientists beat Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Another one that was not quite as bad, quantum measurement beyond the Heisenberg uncertainty limit. So to a lot of people, that's kind of like saying scientists can travel faster than light in a vacuum, especially if they're wearing tutus. I mean, it's like one of those fundamental principles that you just can't be overcome. So, of course, I was very interested to see what the hell was going on there. You know, I understand the need. You need compelling headlines, and the authors of these articles probably never even write their titles, right? Somebody's job is to come up with titles that are going to grab people. So, and it's hard to come up with a headline, right, that's fair to the science and yet makes you want to read it. The best title I came across, I think is actually the name of the paper that was published in Nature, was Interaction-Based Quantum Metrology Showing Scaling Beyond the Heisenberg Limit. Now, that really describes what's going on there, but it's like it's not yelling, read me. It's really kind
it's
of
not
a,
that catchy.
You know, not catchy at all. So, and it's funny, though, because I'm actually even torn a bit on this specific title, because on the other hand, if you even know who Heisenberg is,
you don't know where he is.
That's half. That's half the battle, you know, because if you know what the hell they're even talking about,
that's the drug dealer from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm telling you, more people probably thought
it
was
an awesome show. Anyone who hasn't seen Breaking Bad,
check it
out.
Buy
it, download it, do what you can, watch it. It's awesome.
Come over to your house.
After you watch Dexter, watch that one. But if you actually understood, if you know the title and if it rings a bell with you, then you already have an interest in science and half the battle is kind of already over.
That's true.
But if you have no idea who he is, then, you know, the heinousness of the title is kind of lost on you and you wouldn't even read it anyway. So it's
Bob,
not,
give us
kind of weird
on what it is and that, so people can appreciate what's being discredited.
Definitely a quick overview is needed. Werner Heisenberg is a giant in the physics community. He was one of the key contributors to the theory of quantum mechanics in the early 20th century, and best known for his Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, or more commonly known as the uncertainty principle. Now, this is one of the most important and fundamental insights into the nature of reality that I'm aware of. He discovered that certain pairs of fundamental properties, like position and momentum, which are like the canonical examples, they cannot both be determined with arbitrary accuracy at the same time. So the idea is that the more you know where a particle is, the less you can know how fast it's going. And you could know one attribute. If you knew it perfectly, then you could know absolutely nothing about the other one. So they kind of play off each other in that way. The most important takeaway, though, is that this is not a limitation due to our technology at all. It doesn't matter how advanced your technology is. It's how nature presents itself to us. So it was quite a watershed moment in physics, and in one stroke, Heisenberg does away with the whole idea of Newtonian determinism, his clockwork universe in which everything can be predicted if you just extrapolate from what's going on right now.
The act of observing it limits how much information you can get when you're on that level.
I don't think it has anything to do with the act of observation. It's a fundamental property of matter at the quantum level, that these properties are actually indeterminate. It's not only that we can't know or can't tell, they're actually not certain in their own existence. You know what I mean? It's
okay.
A property of matter itself. It's nothing to do with our ability to get at the information.
There's a certain irreducible amount of uncertainty that we will never, ever, in principle, ever get around. There's just no way around it. Now, the experiment itself is kind of esoteric. I'll quickly go over the actual experiment. This is Morgan Mitchell and his colleagues at the Institute of Photonic Sciences at Barcelona. So what they did was they bombarded a million ultra-cold rubidium atoms with lasers to measure the small magnetic field that the atoms produced. Now, normally the photons that make up the laser beam would change when they interact with this magnetic field. Their polarization would change a bit. So what they did, though, is they tweaked this laser beam such that the photons also indirectly interacted with themselves as well as the magnetic field of the rubidium atoms. So the takeaway from that experiment is that this new method led to an increase in the accuracy of their measurements that exceeded what most scientists thought was possible through this Heisenberg's limit. So is everything I just said before that, is it all bullshit because of this new experiment? You know, can we just ignore his principle since we have the even better techniques now that will find ways around them? Or, you know, does this prove Heisenberg wrong? I guess is the question.
I vote no.
Yeah, it's what the title of the article leads you to believe, and of course the answer is no. The uncertainty principle has not been affected by this. It's still as true and as important as it ever was. What has changed, though, is that it shows that the scientists do not fully understand how the principle scales to multiple particle systems. And that's really all it's done. Our statistical interpretation has been modified, but not the principle itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this reminded me of those experiments that get published every now and then where someone thinks that they've exceeded the speed of light in a vacuum. And it turns out that it's just an illusion of the experimental setup.
Right.
Yeah, I think we described this
exactly
as moving from the back of a car to the front of a car, but the car is still only going, you know, at the speed of light, but that could create the illusion that, you know, the average weight of the car is sort of moving faster than the speed of light. Physicists get tricked by that phenomenon every now and then, and they think they've broken the speed of light when they really haven't. This is a similar thing where it's just sort of more of a trick of how they're looking at the data, not so much really breaking the uncertainty principle.
there's also some interesting stuff can come out of this. With this method, they'll be able to create more sensitive searches for gravitational waves, which they've been looking for such a long time now. These gravitational waves are ripples in space-time triggered by massive objects moving. So that would be great if they could do that. They could also improve brain imaging and atomic clocks, and so all great stuff that can come out of this. So it's not just some little esoteric thing that
right.
is not going to make any difference. I mean, this could have some big differences in science.
Cool, Evan. Have archaeologists found a picture of a brontosaur on petroglyphs?
Did you?
Yes,
in Utah.
Yeah. Well, depends who you talk to, right?
Scientists or creationists?
Exactly. That is the defining line there. Yeah, so creationists are claiming that there's evidence that humans lived alongside dinosaurs some 6,000 years ago. So what exactly is that evidence? It's these petroglyphs, which are man-made carvings in stone, which were discovered at a 6,000-year-old archaeological site in Utah. And according to the creationists, they depict dinosaurs and men or people coexisting, right?
Like living together?
Yes.
Well, if a person drew it and it's a picture of a dinosaur, then the person must have seen a dinosaur. That's the implication.
That's the implication.
They didn't have imaginations or fossil digging skills.
Not that long ago.
Actually, the answer is a lot simpler than that.
It is.
Evan?
Okay.
Because upon closer investigation of these petroglyphs, these images that are purported to be dinosaurs are really not at all depictions of dinosaurs at all. They were analyzed, and they analyzed four of these alleged dinosaur images with the naked eye and with binoculars and lenses and other things. They were illuminated with direct and indirect sunlight when they were in shadow, and the researchers found the neck and
They're
head
the
of
rapsids.
The dinosaur. Very good. The neck and head of the dinosaurs are a composite of two separate petroglyphs. And the legs, or the supposed legs that the creationists say are legs, are simply stains.
What's a petroglyph?
Stone carving.
Stone carving. Carvings in slabs of stones.
Just asking.
Petro, stone, glyph.
I get it.
Stone writing. Yeah, so they're mud stains. The dinosaur-looking bits were just mud stains.
So it's really just pareidolia we're talking about here.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
really is. Yeah.
Did they really, though, did they never draw anything that they hadn't seen?
Fanciful.
Not that I know of.
I mean, why would that be a recent discovery in terms of human history? Why would it take us that long to fantasize about things that don't exist?
Well, in art, I mean, at least in the Western tradition, it was mostly representational for a long time. Mm. You know, and often copying nature. That's how it began.
I'm going to put a Mad Art Lab contributor on this case to figure out when we started making artistic representations of fantastical creatures.
Yeah. But this, yeah, certainly if there was a drawing of that was recognizably a specific kind of dinosaur, like a brontosaurus, that would be very interesting. I wouldn't chalk that up to imagination or fantasy. You know, if it really matched.
Well, if it had
details,
sure.
Yeah, if it was detailed enough. Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Oh, come on. We'd still say baloney.
No, but I'm saying that would be interesting. But we're not even there. It's basically two squiggles and then mud stains.
Oh.
It's not even an animal. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's...
It's pathetic. It's really pathetic.
Yeah.
Well, what do you expect from creationists? I mean, really, I was kind of reading this article.
They expect them to be pathetic.
They're
pathetic. One of the lead paleontologists on this project was quoted as saying, "Until our study, this was the best dinosaur petroglyph. That is the hardest to argue about because it looks so much like a dinosaur, there was no way to interpret anything else. But the best dinosaur is now extinct."
I don't think that it even really looked much like a dinosaur. I think you're still reaching.
Yeah,
even when you throw the mud stains in there, I think you're still reaching. But you can kind of see how it is pareidolia, how they kind of put it together.
Without
the mud stains, it's not even close. I mean, you can't see it. All right, well, let's move on. Evan, tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy?
Here is last week's Who's That Noisy? Now, I had asked our listeners to take a good close listen to that. Obviously, it was something occurring in nature. You could hear kind of the nature noises and the birds tweeting in the background. But there was something else in there that was distinctly unique. And it was up to them to guess exactly what that was.
Uniquely distinct. Was that duck pin bowling?
Duck pin bowling. It was one of many good guesses. There were a lot of good guesses on this one.
Well, what was it?
That was the sound of a sonic boom caused by a meteorite traveling through the atmosphere.
Cool.
Specifically, the Bovedi, B-O-V-E-D-Y, the Bovedi meteorite from 1969, which is supposedly the world's first ever recording of a natural sonic boom.
Cool. Do you hear somebody saying in the background faintly, yeah. What was that?
Yeah, yeah. I heard that.
So it was subtle in a way, but at the same time, very interesting.
Oh, that was neat. Did anybody get that?
There were no correct guesses for that one.
Yeah, wow.
I didn't recall hearing any correct guesses.
Wow, a shutout.
That was sent in to us by our listener and from the message boards. He goes as Gary LQ. So thank you, Gary, for supplying us with last week's
Gary wins.
Yep. Well done, Gary.
Good job. All right, what do you got for this week, Evan?
Okay. Here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
The front of the tube is coated with a special chemical which lights up when the electrons hit it. And this is what makes the picture.
I completely recognize that. Oh, my God. I know who...
Anyone under 40 is at SOL this week.
Okay. Oh, that's a good
All right.
one, Evan.
So there is this week's Who's That Noisy. Post your answer on our forums or send us an email. And good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. We have a great interview coming up with Kenny Fader, our resident archaeologist, in just a few minutes. But we're going to do one email this week. This one comes from Michael Waters from Ottawa, Canada. And Michael writes, saber-toothed vegetarian serapsid. Gah! Curses to you, newspaper headlines, ignorant of animal taxonomies. Therapsids are not dinosaurs. They are early mammals and are no more related to dinosaurs than the marine plesiosaurs or flying pterosaurs. Some amateur paleontology would tell you that dinosaurs don't really have specialized teeth. They are instead all fairly uniform in shape and use. Insert more futile dinosaur nerd rage. In closing, don't lump the filthy, unwashed masses, therapsids, in with my dinosaurs. Bug Girl's not the only one that gets ticked by taxonomical ignorance. Love the show. Please don't do that again. So Michael is referring to Rebecca's science or fiction from last week when she – I don't know if that was in the article you were reading.
It was. Yeah. This will teach me to throw in one last item at the last minute because if you'll recall, last week I did science or fiction and I had three items ready to go and I thought – you know what? I'm going to throw in a fourth one just to improve my chances a bit. I grabbed this, the dinosaur, the saber-toothed dinosaur. I'm putting that in scare quotes. You can't see. Because it was in my feed reader and had a hilarious picture of a stupid buck-toothed looking crazy dinosaur thing.
Dinosaur-like thing.
And that was like a huge mistake because there were actually two big mistakes in that item. One is that it it was not a dinosaur. It was in fact a therapsid, which if I had known would have been the perfect way to get one over on you guys for science or fiction.
Yeah.
Like that would have been excellent. You never would have gotten that.
Yeah.
Because yes, all of the articles that I saw said dinosaur all over them. And it just so happens that the one article that I pulled from also called the people who discovered the bones archaeologists. I said archaeologists and no one else caught it and wow, that was dumb. So sorry, guys.
All right. Well, this incident inspired me and we are going to play a game this week, a new game.
Uh-oh.
This game is called Is It a Dinosaur?
Oh.
I'm going to give you a list of things, and you have to tell me if these things are dinosaurs or not.
I can't imagine this being a running
This is a one-off. This is going to be
when
a one-off.
When are we starting the game, Steve?
Right now. Dinosaurs, for a little bit of background, are a superorder of reptiles that lived from the late Triassic, 230 million years ago, to the end of the Cretaceous, 65 million years ago. So we're going to start with an easy one, just to ease you guys into this. Tyrannosaurus rex, is that a dinosaur or not?
Yes.
Yes, that is a dinosaur.
I say yes.
Yes, T-Rex, that is a dinosaur. All right, what about a pterodactyl?
No, that is not a dinosaur.
Pterodactyls were a separate order of flying reptiles.
Right. And they were called the...
They were called pterodactyly.
Pterodactyls, yeah.
You would have gotten it eventually.
What about a triceratops?
Yes.
Ooh.
I hope so.
I think so.
Triceratops were dinosaurs.
And that's my favorite dinosaur to say in my geek voice. Triceratops.
Don't they have an alternate name? Am I thinking of the right name?
Torosaurus.
Don't they all have alternate names? Like, they changed them all.
There is a debate about whether or not Triceratops and Torosaurus are the same species or not.
Oh, but one's a juvenile, right?
Yeah. Just different ages. What about Iguanodon?
No.
Well, I'd say no.
Not a dinosaur.
I say no.
They were well before dinosaurs, I think.
Iguanodon is a dinosaur.
What? Really?
Yep. Really?
I was so sure about that one.
Yep. Plesiosaurus.
That should have been my first hint.
Sounds like a dinosaur, but...
No.
Plesiosaurus is not a dinosaur. This is a swimming reptile.
Yes.
What people refer to when they think that Loch Ness Monster could have been a dinosaur, but really they're talking about a plesiosaurus.
So what is the word... what is the term saurus?
Saurus just means lizard.
Lizard.
Okay.
Yeah,
I never knew that.
I actually had in here, Evan, the petroglyph at Kachina Bridge in Utah. Not a dinosaur.
not a dinosaur. unless you're a creationist and therefore everything flies out the window.
What about Archaeopteryx lithographica?
No.
Oh.
Is it a dinosaur, though?
No, it wouldn't be, would it?
I'm going to say yes.
It's a fossil of the gap.
Bob's going the other way.
Archaeopteryx
so
is a dinosaur.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh, come on. Really?
Sure you were.
Yes. All right. What about Dimetrodon? Remember, Dimetrodons, these are the creatures with the huge sails on their back that are very popular in science fiction movies.
No.
Those are related to the dimetrically opposedon.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Why don't you work on the joke some more?
They're like proto-dinosaurs. They're like before dinosaurs.
I like this game. We should do it every week.
Dimetrodons are not dinosaurs. They are synapsids. The way you could tell is that their legs come out to the sides and down. They don't come straight down like dinosaur legs do. Like lizards or crocodiles.
Iguanas, yeah.
Yeah. What about Diplodocus?
No.
No.
I don't even know what that is. What's it look like? Describe it.
It looks like.
Is it bigger than a bread box?
Looks like a dinosaur.
Diplodocus is a dinosaur. It's one of the long-necked dinosaurs.
Okay. That is a dinosaur then.
Yes.
Why didn't you say a apatosaurus or something? All right, go ahead.
What about Barney?
Yes.
No. giant.
No, that's puppet. A stupid person in a costume.
Yes, Barney is a mammal of ambiguous gender.
and sexuality.
Purple fuzzy costume, yes.
Well, what kind of dinosaur are they pretending that he is, though?
A T-Rex.
Yeah, it's got to be a T-Rex.
Nice to let your T-Rex, let your kids play with a T-Rex.
The T-Rex with the flat teeth.
What about Ambulocetus?
I don't know.
No. I don't know.
Yes, I'm going to go with yes.
The answer is no. Ambulocetus is a whale ancestor.
That's a whale ancestor, yeah.
Cetus, whale. Ambulocetus means a walking whale.
Mm-hmm.
A very dramatic transitional fossil.
Steve, did you know all these before you looked them up?
I did this off the top of my head, Jay.
you're so cool.
The animal relief carving. All right, I did look up a couple of names. But the ones that I've given you so far, I think I did off the top of my head. The animal relief carving at the Cambodian temple at Angkor. And I wrote a blog post about this a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I don't read your blogs, Steve.
Say it again. What is it again?
The animal relief carving at the Cambodian temple at Angkor. There's a carving. There's animals on this temple, right, carved into the stone. And one is said to be a dinosaur.
Then it's not.
I'm
going to
go with no, considering our previous discussion.
If it's said to be a dinosaur, it's
How old is the carving? Can you tell us that?
I'm going to say no. It's not a dinosaur.
I mean, it's ancient. It's it's not.
It's not a dinosaur.
Then I'd say no.
So the claim is that it's a carving of a stegosaurus.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It's superficially compelling, isn't it?
Well, yeah, outer one looks to be like a serpent, right? You can kind of see an eye and a head there.
Yeah.
And then the inner one, Wow, that does look like a...
It kind of has the plates along the back like a Stegosaurus might.
It's more like a razorback pig or something.
But they're not necessarily part of the animal, though.
Yeah, it could be a dog standing in front of something.
With a funky head, This is
true.
Not a dinosaur.
I think it's a chameleon.
Well, then that's
the
a
head
bad
on
carving
the serpent
of a
thing looks like a chameleon head.
Yeah, looks like a chameleon head. And there are other chameleons at the site as well. I think it's just a funky chameleon. So, not a dinosaur. Okay, we're almost
done.
What
else you got?
We're almost done. A Dinocephalosaurus orientalis.
Right there in the name.
Ansaurus.
This is a long-necked reptile.
I'm
going to say no.
I'm going to go with Bob because he's been on fire.
Wait, I'm going to say yes because it has dinosaur in its name, for crying out loud. Come on.
I'll say
it does
yes.
have dinosaurus in the name. It's true, Dinocephalosaurus orientalis, but it is not a dinosaur.
Well, then they need to rename the damn thing.
I know, right? Like, what are they doing?
What are they doing to us, really? I mean, why do people get frustrated with science? Because of crap like this. What the hell are they doing to people?
Sure. Thank you, Evan.
It does from 230 million years ago, a little bit before the time of the dinosaurs, right at the edge there. What about a rhinoceros?
No.
I include this, the rhinoceros, because somebody I know who I won't name actually thought it was a dinosaur.
Ooh.
Was it Jay?
No. What about Allodaposuchus?
Yes.
You just made that up. Yabba dabba suckus.
Yabba dabba doos.
Yeah, you're just trying to throw us off in case we're Googling.
How about Dino?
Allodaposuchus is not a dinosaur. It's a crocodile ancestor. Now the suffix suchus, S-U-C-H-U-S, is like Egyptian for crocodile. So that if you see that name, it's usually a crocodilian or a crocodilian ancestor. I say usually because they don't always get the names right. Sometimes they misidentify. Yeah. What about a flamingo?
No.
Yes, the flamingo is a dinosaur.
Yeah,
you could
cladist,
complete that argument.
If you're a cladist, then all birds are dinosaurs. In fact, they really...
I knew you were going to throw a bird in there.
They're
not dinosaurs. They're ancestors of dinosaurs.
No, descendants, you mean. But they're still... If they're within the dinosaur clade.
Clade.
So they're technically dinosaurs. In fact, some of the cladists have started referring to what we think of as dinosaurs as non-avian dinosaurs. Just to be clear.
Shit. That's not right.
Non-avian dinosaurs.
NAVs.
What about Supersaurus?
Yes.
I've had that.
Well, yeah.
Sure.
Say.
Bigger than T-Rex? Is that why they call it that?
Supersaurus is, in fact, a real name of a dinosaur.
Yeah. Big boy.
How many fossils of that do they have?
How about Seismosaurus?
Seismosaurus, that's a big guy. Yep, absolutely.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Seismosaurus, it's like a really, really big...
How about Gigantosaurus? Does that guy exist?
Didn't we have this discussion before?
What's the smallest dinosaur?
Yeah, it's ringing a bell, Rebecca.
How small can you get a dinosaur?
One more.
Tiny.
Tiara Judens eccentricus.
It sounds adorable, whatever it is. I don't know. Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Never heard of it.
I'll say no. Yeah.
That is the taxonomical name of the saber-toothed creature that you talked about last week.
Ah, that guy. That wasn't in the crappy article.
Right.
The one the archaeologist found.
That is an anomodont therapsid, not a dinosaur. Right. That's the saber-toothed vegetarian from last week. Yep.
We didn't do terribly.
Yeah, not too bad. That was fun, wasn't it?
Thanks to Bob.
It was fun. I'm shocked at how little I actually know about dinosaurs. I just assumed I had...
All right. Good job, guys. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Kenny Fader. Kenny, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
It's great to be here, Steve. Great to be back on the Skeptics Guide to the Universe.
And Professor Fader is a professor of archaeology at the Central Connecticut State University and the author of many books on archaeology, including Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, Science and Pseudoscience in Archaeology.
So many wonderful books. Suitable for Christmas presents, end of the world parties in 2012, whatever you like.
And you have been gracious enough to be essentially our resident skeptical archaeologist on this show. And I contacted you recently about a recent news item about a possible pre-Clovis find in Texas.
Right.
first remind us what the Clovis culture is, and so we can put this into perspective.
I mean, the deal about this is that, you know, it's been a long controversy concerning the timing of the first human settlement of the New World. This has been an ongoing controversy for about a century. And the nice thing about it is when you look at it, you know, long term, large scale, you see that archaeology has in fact worked like a science, that hypotheses have been tested, hypotheses have been rejected, new consensuses have been built. And this has been going for a long time. In fact, what we're seeing now in archaeology is pretty similar to what was going on in the 1920s and 30s when people were very skeptical about the possibility of a late Pleistocene or late Ice Age occupation of the New World. So that for most archaeologists, the perspective was that American Indians, Native Americans had not been here for much more than about 3,000 or 4,000 years. And there were a smattering of sites that seemed to imply an older date, mm-hmm. 10,000, 11,000, 12,000. And until, however, some really definitive finds were made, and this one was in New Mexico at a site called the Folsom Site, where they actually found the remains of an extinct form of bison that clearly had been extinct from about 10,000 years ago, and spear points were found actually embedded in the rib cage of these bison. You can't get better, you know, a better smoking gun. That's a bad metaphor, I guess, a mixed metaphor. But you can't get a better smoking gun than that. I mean, here you've got a dead animal with a human-made spear in its chest cavity, and those animals became extinct 10,000 years ago. That the consensus shifted. The consensus previously that it had only been 3,000 or 4,000 years was abandoned, and this new consensus was reached that something 10,000, 11,000, or 12,000 was the period of the earliest settlement of the New World. Now, I mean, I was in graduate school 35 years ago, and we were talking about this the controversy of even older sites than Clovis. And there were a bunch of publications in the early 70s in which a number of sites were proposed. Every one of those sites fell apart on some aspect of the data. The dating didn't work out. The stratigraphy was messed up. The artifacts were, in fact, not artifacts. One of the geologists, skeptical geologist, C. Vance Haynes, coined the term geofacts. And for him, geofacts were, well, they're things that were broken up pieces of rock, but they were so primitive. In fact, they hadn't been made by people. They had been made by natural processes of weathering and erosion, of two rocks smacking against one another in a stream, or something falling off of a cliff, smacking, forming flakes, which were so vague and so primitive looking that in fact they turned out not to be legitimate artifacts. However, in the ensuing 30 years or so, 35 years since I've been in graduate school, a number of sites have turned up, which even the most skeptical of archaeologists and geologists have said, you know, this seems like pretty good evidence. We've got a convergence of evidence indicating that, in fact, these sites are pre-Clovis. This latest one in Texas, the Deborah Friedkin site, is it's not nearly as earth-shaking as some of the sort of breathless reporting would have us believe. It is, in fact, another site that reflects this growing consensus that the earliest settlement of the New World, in fact, predates Clovis, and is something somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 years ago is when the earliest human occupation of the New World can be traced to.
But what about the sheer number of artifacts? It seemed to me that there was a lot.
There's 15,000 artifacts. You know, one of the things you have to understand that when archaeologists count artifacts, we're counting every blessed little chip of stone. So I've got a site in Avon that's 4,000 years old, and I tell people there were 16,000 artifacts. People get all excited. Oh my God, 16,000 artifacts! It's the square footage of the site is less than the average single family house, and of those 16,000 artifacts, about 15,800 of them are little tiny chips of flake, smaller than your fingernail, produced as people were making stone tools. There are only a couple of hundred actual tools in that grouping. So you've got to be really careful. Archaeological artifacts, these things expand. The number of artifacts expand sort of exponentially when you start counting every blessed stone flake. And that's, I think, what we have here. This is a great site, and there's some really terrific artifacts. And in fact, the article in Science shows a handful of these. Clearly, these are made by people. But the 16,000 number is a little bit misleading.
Yeah, I think they said there were 56 tools.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Kenny, when you have that many artifacts that are found, do you find use for each one of them? Like, does each one of them give you more information, or is it just redundancy?
Well, I mean, the deal is, if you're talking about looking at how people made tools, then every one of them gives you a little additional piece of information about how the tools were made. Again, the vast majority of these things were left on the ground and abandoned. It's called debitage, which means just waste flakes. But looking at the individual flakes, you might be able to tell if the tools were made by the result of percussion, that is smacking the rock with another rock, or pressure, say an antler pressed against the tool to peel flakes off, if it was direct or indirect. In some cases, you can even sort of kind of tell if the stone toolmaker was left-handed or right-handed. So yeah, there's a bit of redundancy in there, but it's always interesting to look at this carefully to get an idea of exactly what the technology is. And that's part of the deal is, you know, when you're looking at stone tools and you're trying to compare different groups and say, are these the same people? Sometimes you want to just look at the form, the morphology of these things, and if they're similar, maybe they have a common source. But sometimes it's more important to look at exactly the steps undertaken in the process of making the tools. And sometimes, though, in those cases, if you have two different toolkits, because the people are performing different tasks, but the way they were made is exactly the same, little idiosyncrasies of how the flakes were taken off, that can be helpful as well in identifying a connection between two different sites.
Do you have an opinion, Kenny, on the dating method that was used in this site?
Yeah, I mean, archaeologists, you know, number one, we love dendrochronology, tree ring dating, because that's both accurate and precise. I mean, we can date sites to within a year. There's no plus or minus there. Dendrochronology only goes back about 11,000 years in the American Southwest. And, you know, we don't very often find whole logs preserved for that long that we can then compare to the master sequence of tree ring dates. The next best option is radiocarbon dating, because we have a really good understanding of how that works. It's proved itself again and again and again when it's tested against, for example, dendrochronological dates. In this case, the researchers didn't come up with enough charcoal or enough organic material to use radiocarbon dating. So they used an alternate technique, which is not as reliable. It's optically stimulated luminescence. The good news here is that they've got a whole bunch of them, and they are internally consistent. What I mean by that is there is a Clovis level at this site. There's a Folsom, which is a little bit more recent Paleo-Indian level at this site. And they got optically stimulated luminescence dates from those layers, and those dates match the radiocarbon dates for those layers at other sites. So when you're looking at, gee, all the other dates seem to match what we would expect. This is a multi-component site. This place was occupied again and again and again, and all of the other OSL dates match exactly what we'd expect for the kinds of styles of tools that we find in the various stratigraphic levels. So what these guys are doing is they are making an assumption, which is, you know what, if all the other dates are right, then these dates at the lower part of the stratigraphy are probably correct as well. The date you see again and again is this 15,500. However, if you really look at the plus or minus one standard deviation here, the site could be as recent as about 13.8. So somewhere between 13.8, 15.5 is our best guess. They're pushing for the 15.5 date. They believe that that's more reasonable. But it could be, let's say, it's somewhere, you know, late 13,000 all the way up to possibly 15.5.
Okay, and what's the oldest that the Clovis culture goes to?
The Clovis radiocarbonates, we're looking at something like 12,000, 12,500. That's the max. And Folsom, which is different kind of stone tool, different adaptation. The Clovis hunters are usually associated with woolly mammoth and mastodon. The Folsom is almost always associated with a prehistoric, an extinct species of bison. And Folsom is a little bit more recent than that. I mean, the cool thing here is that, you know, one of the mysteries about Clovis has always been, where does the technology come from? Because the specific technology with these big
aliens.
Panels. Well, it could be aliens. we'll check on the History Channel for that. But these big channels that come off of these flakes, of these tools.
The fluting,
right. You don't see that anywhere other than North America. You can't say, well, they brought it over the Bering Land Bridge. It's invented someplace in the American Midwest. Well, if it's invented, there has to be somebody there before who comes up with this idea? So when you've got sites like this with the Deborah Friedkin site or Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania or in the southeast, the Topper site or the Cactus Hill site, you've got the possibility for a thin scatter of people scattered across the North American interior who are the source population for Clovis. Somewhere in the Midwest, somebody invents this. It gets gangbusters, man. It's a stone tool with a bullet. It spreads all over the place because it's just so effective and efficient.
Goes viral.
There you go. And that's an even better – that's a more a less anachronistic metaphor than with a bullet, which is what they used to say with old 45 records on the top 10, right?
Yeah.
So, again, we're describing the stone tools that they left behind, and this doesn't necessarily tell us that the pre-Clovis and the Clovis, they could have been the same actual people, right?
Yeah, I mean, that. In fact, that sort of is the implication in the science articles. These guys are saying, look, Clovis shows up sort of instantaneously, these fluted points. Well, these people, they're there in the Midwest. They had to be somebody there beforehand so that folks like the people at this site may in fact be the ancestors of the folks who developed the Clovis technology.
Why do we say Clovis? What is the meaning of that word?
There's a site in New Mexico where typically in archaeology, when a site is discovered, the first time that tool is defined, it ends up with the name of that site. So the Clovis site is Clovis, New Mexico. It's a town in New Mexico where these specific kinds of tools were first found. Folsom sites, same kind of a deal. It's where those first the first ones were discovered and identified, defined. So the name just sticks with the site name. And the site's named after the town that it was located near.
Kenny, why do we have such a hard time finding organic material at 15,000 years old?
Oh, man, because we wish it were otherwise, you know? Nature is really, really good at recycling organic stuff. So that here in the Northeast, it's sort of epically bad because, number one, we have a lot of freezing and thawing, which is mechanical weathering that breaks stuff up. We have a whole lot of microorganisms who their job is to recycle all that organic stuff, to eat all that bone, to eat all that dead flesh. And we have very acidic soils here. And so the acids, again, are a chemical way of breaking down all this stuff. The only organic material usually that we find is stuff that's here in the Northeast is if it's waterlogged or if it's burned. You know, when it's burned, that sort of takes it out of that whole cycle and the little microorganisms don't want to eat it. So we will find chunks of charcoal that are thousands of years old, bits of bone that are thousands of years old, but only when they're burned. You know, in Texas, the preservation is probably a little bit better there. But again, you know, if you've got people hunting and you've got animals, scavengers pulling away the stuff, and you have, again, chemical weathering, physical weathering, biological weathering, erosion, that stuff tends to disappear in a hurry.
To get back to the recent discovery, a lot of people in the U.S., particularly those of the Mormon faith, have this idea that the Americas were populated long before what scientists seem to currently believe. Does this kind of discovery lend any credence to those claims?
How about, oh my God, no. is that clear enough?
Just checking.
The Mormons have a really, really interesting and sort of different perspective. In fact, I'm preparing with a couple of colleagues a couple of articles on a video that's being it's not an officially sanctioned video by the Mormon Church, but clearly the themes are Mormon about where the Indians came from. And these guys in this video that we participated in sort of willingly thinking that this was going to be about Native Americans, it turned out not to be. It turned out to be about how the Galilee Druze 2,000 years ago entered into the New World and started building all these mounds in Ohio. There's absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. You've got there are a number of very peculiar ideas about when the Americas were settled and how and by whom. But when you look at the archaeological record, the really cool thing about the archaeology is a historical science, which means that it's a lot more difficult than, say, in physics or even biology or chemistry, to come up with definitive answers. We don't do a lot of experiments where in the end, we have a beaker with a result that proves categorically that something happened when it happened. So, but one of my favorite books is the book by Michael Shermer and what is it, Alex Grubman, about the Holocaust denial. Mm-hmm. And he talks about that in historical sciences, we look for a convergence of evidence so that any one piece of evidence might not be sufficient to prove a particular case. But when you've got several parallel streams of evidence that are independent, that one doesn't rely on the other, and they all point in exactly the same direction, we become a hell of a lot more confident that our conclusion is supported. And in the case of the earliest settlement of the New World, we've got archaeological evidence, geological evidence, and biological evidence that all converge. The oldest archaeological sites in northeastern Asia are about 20,000 years old. The oldest sites in the New World are about 15,000 years old. The Bering Land Bridge, that is this connection between the Old and New World, which would have made migration from the Old World to the New World extremely easy. I'm sorry I call it a Bering Land Bridge. I should call it Beringia, because when I say Bering Land Bridge, I think some of my students imagine this narrow isthmus that, you know, Asians have to walk across single file to come to the New World. Well, Bering Land Bridge is like, it's 1,000 miles wide from north to south.
Right.
It is a huge connection between Asia and the Americas. And we know that was, if you look at the geological evidence for that, it's very clear that land bridge was open and available for people to migrate through. It's between 35 and 10,000 years ago. That's, well, if you've got sites in Asia 20,000 years old, you've got sites in America's 15,000, you have this major route of transportation of migration that's open during that specific period. It's at its peak. That's, again, converging evidence. When we look at the biological evidence too, and these are – biological anthropologists don't really give care at all about what archaeologists would like to hear or what geologists would like to hear. But when biological anthropologists look at, say, mitochondrial DNA, the DNA in our mitochondria, and they look at the mitochondrial DNA in living Native American populations, mtDNA that's been extracted from bone, both in the New World and the Old World – and these guys do their little magical calculations of mutation rates and the rate at which mitochondrial DNA changes. And these guys independently come up with numbers like somewhere between 16 and 20,000 years ago, there was a split between people in Northeast Asia and the native people of North America. It's like, well, you can't ask for better convergence of data. So when you get a site like this that's 15,000 years old, in fact, it doesn't cause us to lose our minds and tear our hair out. It exactly fits what the growing consensus is. And if I can toot my own horn here, you know, a couple of people contacted me after the site was in Science, or it's just coming out in Science now, but people have read about it and they say, well, does this completely throw away everything you archaeologists have been saying about the earliest settlement of the New World? And I say, well, get a copy of the latest edition of my World Prehistory textbook, Past in Perspective, came out several months ago, and you'll see this argument, this consensus being presented that, you know, probably Asians came into the New World something like 20,000 years ago. At that time, Alaska, Central Alaska, was a cul-de-sac, because at the same time that the glaciers are at their maximum and the Bering Land Bridge is at its maximum, the glaciers on land, the large Cordilleran Glacier that's centered in the Rocky Mountains, the large Laurentide continental glacier that's centered in eastern Canada, these things coalesced, forming an impenetrable barrier to movement south. So 20,000 to about 15,000, 16,000 years ago, these guys coming into Alaska are stuck there. We have some sites in Alaska that date to that period pre-15,000. This the coalesced ice, it's not like, well, you just put some studs on your snow tires and you get across this. It's 2 miles thick ice, impenetrable. Yeah. Once this ice-free corridor opens up, something like 15 to 16,000 years ago, then people can migrate south following animal herds into the heartland of the Americas, and that's how they get to Pennsylvania 13,000 years ago, or maybe Texas 15,000 years ago.
But we haven't found a lot of human remains.
No, the oldest human skeletons in North America are, you know, maybe 10,000. 10,000 is about max, maybe 11. And, yeah, very few of them. Again, it's largely because of the environment of deposition is really lousy for the preservation of human remains in most of the areas where people have been looking.
Were they Clovis?
Most of the human remains are probably post-Clovis, in fact. So we don't have there are very few human remains that are attributable to the Clovis people.
And I think I heard you say before on a previous interview that we don't have any Clovis points in the same location with human remains.
Right, yeah, yeah. That, which is, again, we don't know. I mean, whether or not human remains are preserved and you're going to find them archaeologically is the product of a whole complex series of variables, not the least of which is how the people actually treated the human remains. So there are plenty of folks, you know, we think of burials as, well, all right, you dig a hole in the ground, you make a coffin, you put the person laid out in there, and you cover it with soil. But, you know, that's not the most common method of burial or body disposal. So you have folks who leave the bodies out specifically for scavengers to take away. You have people who put bodies up in trees, let the buzzards get at them, then they take the bones, grind the bones up, burn the bones, and then bury them in the ground, and that stuff all washes away. So not everybody is intent on trying to preserve that body as best they can. Mm-hmm. So cultural activities can act to destroy those remains. And then you add on top of that the vicissitudes of the environment of deposition, and you are lucky indeed when the human remains are found. You know, and listen, but the same is true for animal remains. I think in all of North America, if there are a dozen or a dozen and a half woolly mammoth remains that have been found across the face of North America in association with Clovis hunters. It really are very few. Bison, there's a lot more. But the reason we find so many more bison is that the Folsom hunters tended to hunt bison by running large groups of them over cliffs.
Oh, yeah.
So you will find at the bottom base of a cliff, you'll find the remains of 200 bison. Mm-hmm. That, well, that must have been something to see, right? This was right out of Looney Tunes, right?
Loud, too.
Wile E. Coyote. It's 200 bison being chased, you know, running like hell and flying over cliffs, falling mostly to their deaths at the bottom of the cliff.
Yeah.
There also are guys there with spears ready to dispatch the last of them. And then they butcher what they can. They leave the rest that they can't get to because they're buried by other bison. And then we'll find the remains of those bison, the remains of the Folsom points in large numbers. But that's a very lucky circumstance, and that is a product of, in fact, the way these guys were hunting them.
So it sounds like, from what you're saying, that there once humans came to the New World, something like 15,000-16,000 years ago, following the herds when the geography opened up, that they've pretty much been here continuously since then. That there really were multiple migrations, or if there were, at the very least, there was one continuous genetic population in the New World. So
that is certainly, yeah. I mean, that's certainly what all the biological anthropologists, when they look at the nuclear DNA, the mitochondrial DNA, the Y chromosomes of living Native Americans and Asians, of skeletal populations of Native Americans and Asians, there's a really nice tight fit. There doesn't appear to be any significant influx of people from anywhere else. Now, that's not to say, I mean, there's a very strong possibility that there were multiple migrations across the Bering Land Bridge. You might have, say, a major migration through the interior, and these guys they have to wait until the Ice Free Corridor opens up for them to enter into the heartland. But you may also have maritime adapted people, coastally adapted people, who are living and hunting along that Bering Land Bridge coast to the south, and those folks may end up sort of skipping. Those guys have a problem as well, because you have glaciers moving from the Rockies into the Pacific. And if you've, you know, anybody who's listening who's ever taken a cruise up to Alaska where they take you along the rim of these ice tongues that are coming into the Bering Sea, you know, that's not a very hospitable environment. But that, we know that though, that probably dissipates by, again, around 15,000 years ago. So if you're living on the coast and just sort of skipping along the coast in your boat and finding safe harbors and hunting marine mammals and fishing and just looking for territory to expand into, that could happen as well. And, you know, it didn't get nearly as much publicity, but about a month and a half ago, Science also published an article about a really old site, close to 13,000, two sites, in fact, that were found on two of the Channel Islands, which are off the coast of Santa Barbara in California. And the evidence there's some faunal evidence of hunting of marine mammals. There are good radiocarbon dates, 12,900, 12,800, something like that, which again is pretty much pre-Clovis and a completely different set of stone tools. You don't see anything like this at the Deborah Friedkin site in Texas. They don't look like Clovis. So you may, in fact, have a group of folks coming down the coast. They're still from Asia, but their adaptation is a little different. They're more coastally adapted, which also explains why in South America, again along the Pacific coast. In Chile, you've got a couple of sites that are just about pre-Clovis, maybe 11,800, 11,900, 12,000 that are along the coast there. So those may be a population of folks who came down, used a coastal route to come into the New World.
So they made it farther south faster, you're saying?
Yeah, well, yeah. Because there you're skipping from essentially from safe harbor to safe harbor as you are expanding, as your population is growing, as you're expanding, as you're looking for more resources.
Well, Kenny, thanks for joining us. It's always a blast talking with you.
You're welcome. Great. Hope you all enjoyed it, and I look forward to the next one.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Kenny.
Have a good night.
Thanks, man.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Everyone ready for this week? Just going to do a regular one this week, just three items.
Ooh.
Ready.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. Researchers have successfully extracted the protein from a 600,000-year-old mammoth. Item number two. Researchers find that greater short-term evolutionary fitness does not always predict long-term survival over competitors. And item number three. Astronomers announced the discovery of the most Earth-like exoplanet discovered to date, orbiting just 2 million miles from a white dwarf star. Evan, go first.
All right. Researchers have successfully extracted the protein from a 600,000-year-old mammoth. I guess the way to figure this one out is to know exactly how long were mammoth around for. And if you know that, I guess you can pretty much nail that one down. The second one is researchers find that greater short-term evolutionary fitness does not always predict long-term survival over competitors. I have a feeling that one's science. I find this to be science, and this is something new, apparently. I don't know why this wouldn't have panned out from prior research or study, and that it's only something recent, but it seems to make a lot of sense to me. The last one, with astronomers announcing the discovery of the most Earth-like exoplanet discovered to date. 2 million miles from a white dwarf star? 2 million miles. The Earth is, on average, 93 million miles from the sun. 2 million. That's inside probably the orbit. I don't know Mercury's orbit. I imagine that's inside the orbit of a planet like Mercury would be. Imagine it's Mercury's further out than 2 million. That's pretty close. That thing must be whipping around that sun. Or that star, like mad. So how could that have an Earth-like exoplanet at 2 million miles? That's a hard one to swallow. But at the same time, something like that is exactly the kind of thing that we would guess that would be incorrect, and therefore it would be correct. And that leaves the mammoth as the lone animal out in the cold. And I'm going to say that one is fiction. Mammoth is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Okay, the protein, 600,000-year-old mammoth. Evan, I kind of disagree. It's not just a matter of knowing how long mammoths have been around. Is it a viable idea? Can protein be viable for that long? That's a big part of the question as well.
You're saying we have no examples of this would be the oldest.
I don't remember. Ever? I think we've found proteins older than that.
I think so too.
Yeah, I'm going to say that one. That one is plausible. But do mammoths? How long have they been? Have they been around that long? God, there was like so many different species of them, or at least elephants. Did you know there used to be 200 species of elephants? Now there's only three.
Next week anyway, we can play. Is it an elephant?
Yeah. So the second one. Greater short-term evolutionary fitness does not always predict long-term survival. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. I think they're. There's lots of subtle variables that would affect that, things in the environment, mutation rates and stuff. So that kind of makes sense to me. Now, this third one, though, the most Earth-like exoplanet discovered to date. Okay, now, part of the reason here is I'm going to pull the card that I occasionally pull that I would have heard of this if it was true. So that's part of why I'm going to say that this is fiction. But also... I think scientists have been bandying about the idea that white dwarfs would make a good parent star for Earth-like planets. Well, actually, because they'd be easy to detect, because the white dwarf star is so tiny that you could easily, with a very tiny telescope, detect planets using the transit method. So there'd be very easy to find planets. But the big concern is the tidal forces. I mean, you've got to be so close to that star to get a good amount of heat, so water's liquid, that the tidal forces would be nasty. But it would be great if white dwarf stars could host planets, because then there's so many white dwarfs out there that it would greatly improve the chances of actually finding Earth-like planets out there. But I don't think that is I don't think that's a real science story. I would have heard about it, and so therefore I'm going to say that is fiction. I'm done.
Oh, okay, Rebecca.
No hubris there.
Oh man,
got to go with some.
That's true.
Well, like Evan, I suppose I was. I think I'm caught between the mammoth protein and the Earth-like planet 2 million miles from a white dwarf star. I can see how greater short-term fitness doesn't necessarily predict long-term survival. So I don't really know much about mammoths and when they were hanging around the planet. And see, I always get mixed up with anything involving large numbers. It's always going to throw me off. So it really helped me when Evan pointed out how far away Earth was from the sun. Because I never remember. I always get things off by orders of magnitude. So that sort of cemented it for me that that's ridiculously close for an Earth-like planet to be to a white dwarf star. So I'm just going to go ahead and say that that one's the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Researchers have successfully extracted protein from a 600,000-year-old mammoth. Steve, that means that we have living DNA, or not living, but that we have some sort of DNA? If they have a structure of a protein?
No, it means they have protein. Protein's protein, DNA is DNA.
Well, I totally can buy that. I think it's a big deal, but I don't think it's something that we couldn't do today as long as it was preserved correctly. Researchers find that greater short-term evolutionary fitness does not always predict long-term survival over competitors. That seems a little counterintuitive. I would say that I'm leaning towards picking that one. And then the last one, astronomers announced the discovery of the most Earth-like exoplanet discovered to date, orbiting just 2 million miles from a white dwarf star. That seems a little odd, too. I'm going to happily not go with the group and pick the one of the I'm going to go with the one about the evolutionary fitness as the fake.
All right. Well, we're all spread out, so I guess I'll take them in order. Number one, researchers have successfully extracted the protein from a 600,000-year-old mammoth. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Of course.
For a little background, mammoths are around, go back to 4.8 million years.
That far. Awesome.
I did not know that.
Yeah, awesome. This is they are in the order Proboscidae, the family Elephantidae, and the genus Mammothus. The genus is now,
that pretty much describes it.
Yep, genus is now extinct. But any member of the Mammothus genus is a mammoth from 4.8 million years ago to about 4,500 years ago. So 600,000 years is right in there, so no problem. So this is researchers from the University of York in Manchester have successfully extracted protein from the bones of a 600,000-year-old mammoth. So this is interesting. Remember, we actually discussed, I think it's now a couple of years ago, researchers who claimed that they extracted collagen proteins from a T-Rex.
Yeah.
But that's been subsequently debunked.
Really?
Yeah. And
I didn't get the memo on that.
Oh, yeah. I think we even talked about it. We got an email on it from a scientist who does this kind of research. And essentially, you know, my subsequent reading is that there's more skepticism than acceptance of that claim, of the T-Rex collagen claim. It was probably just contaminants. But this one seems legit. You know, I looked around, and it seems like people are buying this one. Although, again, you never know with the new news items, you know, what's going to happen when the community dissects it. But they are claiming that they were able to successfully extract the protein. This is from one of the most complete mammoth skeletons ever discovered. It's 85% complete skeleton, preserved by the Norfolk Museum and Archaeology Service in Norwich.
That's Norwich.
Norwich.
By the way. Mm-hmm.
Norwich.
Never pronounce the W's in the middle of words.
Like Greenwich?
Mm-hmm.
I got it.
Greenwich. Yeah.
Or howitzer?
That one I don't know.
If this technique really holds up, then this could really be helpful in examining extinct animals. Because even with a tiny piece of bone, we might be able to then compare it to, you know, known standards, the collagen, and be able to say what species it is, even if it might be just a little chip of bone.
Cool.
Yeah. Could be quite useful.
Well, how long can protein last?
That's a good question. This is getting to the upper limit. I think they said something like 1 million years is probably the upper limit.
Whew. It's a long time.
DNA is useful up to about 100,000 years. Unfortunately, no dinosaur DNA.
Not even in amber.
That's still nothing more than 100,000 years. That's the consensus right now. So let's go on to number two. Researchers find that greater short-term evolutionary fitness does not always predict long-term survival over competitors. Jay, you think this one is the fiction, and this one is also science.
Mm.
Hooray.
Yay, Rebecca. High five.
High five, Bob.
This is a little counterintuitive. you know, obviously, evolution can occur in a lot of quirky ways, but this one is specific research. This was actually done by Richard Lenski. You guys remember his name?
Yeah.
Lenski.
He's the bacteria guy. He's the guy who's been, for like 30 years now, has been keeping track of the evolution of bacteria in his lab and like saving.
Yes, that was awesome.
Generations, so you could actually, you know, dial the evolutionary clock back to a previous iteration, then run it forward again and see what happens. Very, very cool research. You know, good direct evidence for, you know, for adaptation and evolution occurring in the lab. And so it's the same guy. What he showed was that if you have different strains of bacteria, that the bacterial strain that is better adapted to the current environment than another strain will not necessarily predominate over the long term, that the less well-adapted bacteria, if it has a greater chance of having a favorable mutation in the future, may still in the long term outcompete the bacteria that are better adapted in the short term. So, you know, when you wrap your head around the explanation, it's not as counterintuitive. It caught my attention because a lot of the headlines are survival of the fittest is wrong. You know how the headlines are. But yeah, That's not true. It's just the short-term advantages can be overwhelmed by long-term advantages. And the long-term advantages can include things like having a higher frequency of mutations so that the chance of overcoming your shortcomings or your weaknesses is greater in the long term. That's what he showed. Again, not that surprising when you really wrap your head around it in terms of, you know, how evolution works. All of this means that astronomers announced the discovery of the most Earth-like exoplanet discovered to date, orbiting just 2 million miles from a white dwarf star, is fiction.
Woohoo!
But I did base this on a real news story where astronomers were speculating about the possibility of having Earth-like planets around white dwarfs. They haven't actually found one. And Bob, you hit a lot of the points. So a white dwarf is essentially an ember of a burned-out star.
Sun-like star.
A sun-like star, yeah. Not big enough to become a black hole or a neutron star. Like an ember, it still will give off some heat, but obviously not as much as a full burning star. And they're very small. But if a planet were very close to such a star, like 2 million miles, it would actually be in the habitable zone. Like, so if you have a sun-like star, and once it burns its fuel in the core and can't maintain further fusion, it starts to expand to become a red giant, and it would consume and destroy any planets close to it before it then gives off its outer layers and the inner part becomes a white dwarf. So there would have to be some way for a planet in the outer solar system to work its way down into the inner solar system and settle
like the
in.
Hot Jupiters, like the hot Jupiters. They used to at least think that they migrated in.
Yeah, so it would have to be something like that. The planet would have to migrate in and then wind up in a stable orbit close to the white dwarf, but then it could end up in the habitable zone. However, that close, the tidal forces actually would not be a big problem, Bob.
Really?
Because it will become tidally locked. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then once you're locked, you know, there is no tides moving around the planet anymore, right? It's all locked in one position.
That's true.
But that would mean that, you know, the same side of the planet would face the star.
Right.
The,
you'd have a band of habitability.
Yeah, right, exactly. But there might be a habitable band around the transition, the twilight zone from the light side to the dark side, which is interesting. Think about having a planet where that's the habitable zone. It'd be very interesting. But they also said that, you know, the white dwarf would be about the same size and brightness, you know, from that distance that our sun is to us. It'd be a little redder, a little ruddier, but otherwise it would look pretty similar to our sun.
Wow. I want to see a science fiction movie with an alien life on a planet like that. That would be awesome.
That would be cool. I'd love that. So good job, Bob and Rebecca.
Hey. Thank you.
Why don't you just say bad job, Jay and Evan?
Better luck next week, you guys.
That was implied.
Better luck. And always. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote that was sent in by Emerson White, and it's a quote by a man named Brian Kaplan, who is a professor of economics at George Mason University, and he also is a blogger for Econlog, Econlog. And the quote is, there are two sources of error. Either you lack sufficient data or you fail to take advantage of the data that you have. Brian Kaplan.
Thank you, Jay.
Cool.
Nice-ish.
So remember, next week, Nexus, New York, we have plenty of seats, so just show up. Awesome lineup of speakers, lots of events. SGU live show, a show with George Crabb and Phil Plait. Phil Plait is the keynote speaker.
Skeptics in the Pub Friday and Saturday night as well afterwards.
Both nights?
I believe so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hope to see you there.
And if you're not in New York but happen to be in Minneapolis at the end of June, we're having Skepticon once again at Convergence, June 30th to July 3rd. You can find out more at events.skeptic.org. But we're fundraising, and that covers the cost of us putting up our special guests. This year, our guests include Amanda Marcotte of Pandagon, P.Z. Myers, of course, of Pharyngula, Greg Layden of Greg Layden's blog, Desiree Shell, who does Skeptically Speaking, John Abram, a climate scientist, Sadie Crabtree from JREF, Ashley Paramore from Secular Student Association. We've got a whole mess of skeptics there. It's going to be a great time.
Thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, our pleasure.
Science fiction sucked.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice. Theorem is performed by Kineto and used with permission.